if you've listened to 194 episodes of this show and you haven't tasted Lambic, you really got to do it. Do it for us.
It's the Beervana Show, broadcast almost live in Portland on X-Ray FM and in Vancouver at KXRW, or available anywhere on your favorite podcast service. I'm Patrick Emerson, professor of economics at Oregon State University, and with me as always is Jeff Allworth. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Patrick.
Jeff is the author of many books, including The Beer Bible, Cider Made Simple, and others.
Yes.
Others. How you doing?
I'm good. You know, I've worked my way through the royalty or the advance that I got for the second edition of the Beer Bible, and this month I received a royalty check for the Beer Bible, which is nice. So keep buying them, folks, because now I'm getting paid.
Oh wow! So how many copies do you have to sell before you?
It's based on a formula where you take the advance minus every time you sell a book, it counts against the advance,
right?
So I don't want to get into the economics here because it'll only.
Well, it's just like, is this 1,000 books, 10,000 books, 1,000,000 books?
It was probably on the order of 10,000 that I had to sell to get the advance back.
Well, that's a lot of books, man.
Yeah. Yeah. The two combined editions are well over 100,000 copies. I haven't looked at the whole, it's now fragmented so much with foreign editions and all this other stuff. I'm not sure how,
but that's amazing. Congratulations.
It is. Thank you.
And we are here on a beautiful sunny Thursday afternoon in Portland, Oregon. This is the time of season that we really bifurcate.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's the most wonderful time of the year. It's spring. Life is exploding. Trees are leafing out. Pollen saturates the air.
You bet it does.
And I love it.
Yeah. Although we seem to have gotten past whatever was most irritating to my...
Yeah. Last time I saw you, you were suffering.
Yeah. I'm actually doing okay today. Okay. So the last few days, it seems like whatever was blooming that was killing me is fine now.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
And we should introduce the new dog of the pod.
Yeah. I don't know if the mic is picking her up or not.
The dog of the pod is chewing on the bone I brought.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
She's so happy. So that's Rosie, and she's a mutt, 27 pounds of...
Adorable dog.
She
adorable
is very...
Adorable dog, yes.
She's a little black and tan dog.
Very cute. Have you posted anything on Instagram or just on your Twitter?
I posted on my Instagram.
Okay. Instagram and see pictures of Rosie the dog, who's quickly becoming indoctrinated into the life of pubs, Portland pubs.
She's now been to 3.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent. Got to start them early.
She was just yesterday. You'll appreciate this.
Yes.
I went out to talk to Michael Cora at Montevilla.
Oh, nice.
Because he just installed a cask handle. So we sat outside. Yesterday was the first... It's spring, so we're alternating between sunny and cloudy. And yesterday was the first sunny day back after the clouds and cold. And we sat outside, and Rosie managed about an hour and a half before she was ready to get out of there, which is plenty of time to talk about and drink some cask ale. So, yeah, that was good.
Nice.
She's 8 months.
Well, we should talk about today's pod.
We should.
So after a lot of hemming and hawing, and after 195 podcasts, Jeff and I have finally decided to call it quits.
Yeah, which may not come as a surprise to people who have watched our feed just go dormant for months now.
Which is a big part of it. We keep thinking, oh, soon, we're going to have lots of time, it's going to be great, we'll catch back up, and then it just never happens.
No.
And it's getting less and less frequent, less and less reliable, not great. And then we've kind of said a lot of what I think we have to say about beer, quite frankly.
Yeah, we could continue to talk about it forever.
Yeah.
But maybe we don't need to.
And there is an archive of 195 pods I'm pretty proud of. I think that if you were to listen through those pods, you'd learn a ton about beer, the beer business, how to beer styles, how you make beer, things about yeast, things about hops, things about water, you name it. So
95% accurate.
Well, yeah, give or take.
Yeah, give or take.
That's, you know, within a margin of error.
That's right.
But it's beer, so who really cares?
That's right.
Is there really any truth in beer?
Yeah, that's a philosophical question for sure.
And then the other thing, of course, is that soon many of our jobs will become obsolete. And I think pretty much podcasting is is pretty much ready to be made obsolete by the genius of artificial intelligence.
Oh, do you have something in mind, Patrick?
I mean, you could, for example, put in a prompt and make your own podcast, two guys talking about English cask ale, for example.
Let's hear what that would be like.
Yeah, what would that be like?
Hello, beer enthusiasts, and welcome back to Beervana. I'm Patrick Emerson, your guide through the world of economics and, of course, beer.
And I'm Jeff Allworth, your resident beer explorer and author of books like The Beer Bible. Today, Patrick, we're exploring a topic that's steeped in history and flavor, English cask ale.
Ah, cask ale, a topic close to the heart of many beer lovers. Jeff, for those who might not be familiar, what exactly is English cask ale?
Great question, Patrick. English cask ale is like the OG of craft beer. It's beer that undergoes a secondary fermentation in the container from which it's served, often a cask made of metal or wood.
So it's not just about what's in the beer, but also how it's served.
Exactly. The beauty of cask ale lies in its simplicity and authenticity. It's served directly from the cask, sans additional pressure, giving it a distinctive taste and texture.
And what makes it stand out in the vast landscape of beer styles?
Well, Patrick, it's all about tradition and community. Picture an old English pub, the cozy atmosphere, and locals gathering around for a pint of cask ale. It's a piece of living history in a glass.
Jeff, you've explored countless beer styles in your writing. What's drawn you to English cask ale?
Oh, Patrick, it's the authenticity. There's something magical about sipping a well-poured cask ale in a centuries-old pub. It's a connection to the past and a taste of craftsmanship.
Well, it sounds like we're in for a treat today as we unravel the layers of English cask ale. Stay tuned, beer enthusiasts, as we navigate the history, flavors, and perhaps share a few recommendations on this episode of Beervana.
Grab your favorite pint glass and join us for a conversation that's sure to make you appreciate the artistry behind English cask ale.
So you see,
they didn't fumble around as much as we do.
Yeah, you could hear them. They didn't trail off.
That's right. The audio was really good. Content was a little mediocre.
But it is, again, beer. So, I mean, I think you can kind of do your own podcast now.
That's right.
You can modulate the voices. You can do it in your own voices. You can do it in the voice of, I don't know, Scarlett Johansson and Ryan Reynolds or something like that.
Ooh, that would be nice.
Yeah, that would be. See, that would be a good podcast.
Yeah,
I might even pay for that. So really, is there any point to us sitting here doing this, human beings? No, I think human beings are quickly becoming obsolete.
That's right.
Soon, all we'll be useful for is the energy we can provide the AI overlords.
Yeah, I'm ready to red pill myself or blue pill or whatever. I'm ready to go into the matrix. Exactly. It's been a good life. Let's
seriously, this has been a lot of fun. It was many years ago you were explaining to me how modern publishing is all about having your own platform and mm-hmm. convincing a publisher that you can help sell books through the outreach and the audience you already have. And I said, you know what you need to do. It's a podcast. And I don't even know how many years ago. Do you even know the year we started? We should have looked this up before.
Yeah, we should have looked this up. It was like 7 or 8 years ago. It was quite a number of years ago, for sure.
It was quite a number of years ago. I'm gonna do a little looking as we talk, because this is the nature of the podcast. I deleted them all. Okay.
This is the high quality content that you cannot expect your AI to give you, because they'll be prepared.
But anyhow, I didn't expect how much fun it would be, and it was also a great excuse for us to get together and drink beer. And so thank you for all this.
Yeah, it's
been big fun.
It has been big fun. And I would go around the world and people would say, I listen to your podcast. So
yes,
it was pretty cool.
It's always been fun to run into listeners who reveal themselves to us in different parts of the world, in different parts of the country. And
yeah, I think I may have thrown in the towel earlier, but we got such positive feedback that it was cool to keep it going. Yeah. So well, I apologize to everyone who hasn't already gotten tired of us.
Yeah. Well, we'll try to solve that today.
Right.
the conceit of today's podcast is pretty simple. Jeff and I both independently went to the beer store, different beer stores, and picked out beers that the only thing we said to each other was meaningful to us.
Right.
So we got to define that however we wanted. And so what we're going to do in today's pod, we're going to drink some beers, talk about why they're meaningful to us, just reminisce about our beery adventure.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun. It's the kind of podcast we don't really do very often. So
The kind of podcast that we really didn't want to do. Two guys drinking beer and chatting about the beer they're drinking.
Right.
Was just about the one thing we said we shouldn't do as a podcast. And that's exactly what we're going to do today.
Yeah, which I guess... I don't know what that says about us or the podcast or anything else.
I think it's an appropriate coda to the.
That's right.
To the show. All right, we are going to give you a little bit of news though. So first, let's go to the news.
This week, the Brewers Association released their final complete report on the craft beer industry's performance in 2023. The news reflects a mixed bag. Overall, U.S. brewed beer fell 5% by volume, which makes the craft segment's 1% drop relative good news, and craft actually ticked up as an overall percentage of the beer market. It now accounts for a quarter of all beer revenue. Breweries are roughly stable in number now, with 9,800 in operation, and openings still edged out closings.
Well, I think that's good news in a sea of bad news, especially since inflation's still persistent and hurting brewers. So I'm glad to hear that there's been some stability. Hi, dog of the pod. How are you doing?
She wanders by.
Yes, bone has been devoured.
She ate that pretty fast. She's got
sharp little teeth.
Yeah,
have to watch the wires. Sometimes she tries to chew on the cables.
But beer volume, as always, is down overall. That never-ending decline of beer.
Yeah, and this is just in case you're wondering and thought that beer wasn't down that far. The numbers here reflect the domestic production.
Right.
So because Mexican beer is doing so well and imports are doing so well, they're buoying the industry. But if you make and sell beer in America, it ain't so good.
Yeah. It is pretty amazing, though, that at this point we're almost 10,000 breweries in the United States.
Yeah.
Wasn't that long ago. We were just a few. So.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, as recently as like 2010, there were 2,000 or fewer. So it's really exploded. And
it's really, I mean, I've actually done a decent amount of traveling. My son's looking into colleges and stuff, and so we've done some traveling around. And it's really almost impossible to find now a place in the United States where you don't find craft beer.
Yeah.
It's pretty much become the norm. Even in just a sort of obscure restaurant or bar, typically they'll have a craft beer too, and then stores. So it really, the landscape has entirely changed.
It has.
It's part of the culture now.
It's totally part of the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the kids I teach now, they're all native to craft beer.
Right.
Not that they've been drinking it because they're still just turning 21, but
right.
But that's been their experience. That's what beer is no longer a weird offshoot.
Right. They've been to the brew pub with their family. And yeah.
Yeah. So the other news item is that although 10,000 may sound like a lot of breweries, fully three quarters are small. In 2018, the Brewers Association added a separate category for breweries that relied on pub sales but did not offer food. Of those small pub-driven breweries, about equal numbers are brew pubs, or what the Brewers Association calls taproom breweries. So, yeah. Which I think is great. That's probably one of my favorite part of craft beer. It's just the little neighborhood operation.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people say there's too many breweries, and they mention 10,000 as if they're all producing 50,000 barrels, which they're not. Most of them are not selling cans at the grocery store.
Right.
They're little pub breweries that are serve a neighborhood or a small town, and those are good. Those aren't crowding out anybody. So
yeah,
I think we're hitting equilibrium. It's a mature market. No matter where you live, you probably have access to local beer. All that's good.
Yeah, and we've said this ad nauseum, but the overall quality of craft beer has just risen to a point now where it's generally pretty exceptional. So,
totally. Which is a good place for this podcast to leave beer. Our work is done. We've
exactly.
gotten it to, we've got it to a stable
You're welcome,
place.
Welcome, everybody. Yeah. Not only do brewers know how to brew good beer, but customers know what good beer is and demand it.
That's right.
And it's what you want.
Yeah. So, carry on.
All right. Well, with that, maybe we should go find ourselves some good beer and get on with the rest of the podcast.
Let's do it.
All right. And I'll pause.
I can open the back door, but if you bark it.
Okay, we're back.
All right.
So the prompt was to pick beers that are meaningful. And you did it first, and you said, well, I just went into the beer store and looked for beers that spoke to me. And I decided to sort of do the same. I thought a little bit about it ahead of time. But when I was in the beer store and thinking awash in lots of beers, I decided that what really spoke to me was beers that were meaningful to me in sort of, I don't know, my beery journey, particularly with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first beer I picked was the timeless classic Sierra Nevada Pale Ale.
The classic.
And one of the reasons I picked this was because it reminded me of when you and I first started to homebrew.
Yeah.
In Madison, Wisconsin. And back then, the beers that they're sort of homebrew was very much based around English ales. And IPA, I think, is what we brewed. But there was also this version hanging out there, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, which was kind of a standard bearer even at that time.
Yeah, and I remember when we got to Madison, I would love to go back in time because I think you know, Capital existed and somebody else existed in Madison, but they were making lagers, and we couldn't appreciate lagers then. We the citrus flavor of our native hops really drew us, and that's kind of why we got into craft beer. And you obviously couldn't get Oregon craft beer in Wisconsin in the early 1990s, but you could get Sierra Nevada.
We wandered into the wine and hop shop on State Street, has since moved to Monroe Street, but it was on State Street at the time.
Has it?
Yep.
I didn't know that.
I think it moved into the place that used to be Ovens of Brittany, which was when I was growing up. What we used to do in the weekends is go get morning buns there, which are like cinnamon rolls, cinnamon buns. And it's gone. That's sad. But the wine and hop shop persists. And I remember teaching the person how to pronounce Willamette. But also, I think our first IPA was Cascade Hops.
Sure.
I think so. I think it was like a liquid malt extract, English ale malt extract, some yeast, and some Cascade Hops, as I recall, but maybe some other hops. But anyway, this is Sierra Nevada Pale Ale with Cascade Hops.
Awesome. Yeah, I remember that beer. We called it India Dark Ale because for some reason it was really dark.
Well, yes. I think the malt extract was fairly brown.
Mm-hmm. Ah, classic flavor profile.
Mm. So that's kind of what my beer selections represent. This is my first one. And it was kind of, I mean, our intro into craft beer was in college.
Mm-hmm.
Full Sail and Bridgeport.
And the McMinimans.
I was going to say mostly McMinimans, probably. A lot of McMinimans. But this was a big part of it as well.
Yeah, it really was. And it's interesting to see the scope of beer over our lifetimes, because our lifetimes mostly encompass the craft era.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started writing about beer, I always felt a little like an imposter because I wasn't there at the very start.
Right.
But now we're really old, and we count as old timers, and nobody remembers. When I say, oh, I started drinking beer legally in the 1980s, I always see a surprised look on people's face.
Well, this is also a beer that you could get. So, you know, after undergrad, spent some time in Washington, D.C., spent some time in Madison, Wisconsin, spent some time in Ithaca, New York, spent some time in New York City, and Sierra Nevada, you could get everywhere, basically.
Yeah.
Even when I went to Denver, Sierra Nevada was there. So this is a beer that sort of has always been there, and it's kind of amazing that it's still there, still going strong, still pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great beer. You somehow, I think they sell this in cans now, don't they? You found a bottle somehow.
Well, I went to the, in fact, it was hard because what they're really selling a lot of now is the hazy lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had plenty of cans of hazy stuff. And it was hard actually to find. I really wanted just the old traditional pale ale. And I found one bottle on a low shelf.
This beer was so popular. I don't know if you remember this, but this little stubby bottle it comes in, mm-hmm. was called like the Legacy Bottle or something. It had some name. And this beer was so popular that all craft breweries, when they started bottling, put their beer in that bottle shape. Because it was, right. It was like the craft beer bottle. And it's cool to see that they're still rocking that same bottle.
I didn't realize that was the the genesis of the bottle, I figured it was just the cheapest one.
It was probably just the cheapest one. But then, you know, much like once the hazy breweries started putting their hazy IPAs into 16-ounce cans, everybody had to follow. Yeah. It goes all the way back. That everything you think is new is probably not new.
But it takes me back. It's an amber color. It's a little slightly darker than a traditional, what you get now as a pale or an IPA. It's got a little bit more malt flavor so it's slightly heavier.
Yeah, it's way more malty than we think of today as mm-hmm. appropriate for hoppier styles.
It's got that classic Cascade, beautiful Cascade flavor profile.
Sometimes you can become a classic and be out of step with everything else. So it's cool. I think that's pale ale. It still actually sells quite a bit. I don't know what its volume is, but it's pretty, you know, it's probably their third best selling beer or something like that. I mean, it still sells a lot of beer. Yep. A lot of people still buy this beer.
Yep. And why not?
All right. Should I go?
Yeah. Let's just go back and forth. So how did you take the prompt and what did you decide on?
Yeah, I thought I would, my beer journey changed when I became a beer writer and I started going to Europe. And that really, seeing breweries in situ kind of changed my relationship to beer. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, so I've got here Herarden Goose. So the first, which is going to be a stand-in for a giant class of beer that I want to talk about. It was one of the first, when I first read about lambic style beer and spontaneous fermentation back in, I don't know, the 80s or 90s, whenever I first read about it, it seemed impossibly magical to me and very strange and weird. And it was one of the reasons I became a massive beer nerd. And for, I don't know, a lot of years after that, I kind of thought of it as the last of its kind, the last old rustic style of beer. But actually, that's not true at all. And it was the first rustic style brewery I went to. Mm-hmm. Belgium, after you and I traveled through the UK together, I went to Belgium, and the very first place I went was Cantillon. Mm-hmm. And then the next day I went to Cibone, and I visited, I didn't tour the brewery, but I visited Dreyfontein. Mm-hmm. And I've always tried to get to Herarden. I've never done it, but it's one of my favorites. It's probably, this may be my favorite of the lambics. And it was super cool to see old rustic brewing. But then, you know, I learned about rustic brewing in Lithuania and Norway, and I got to see that kind of rustic brewing. And we're going to have another beer here that I'll take. We'll talk about a little bit later, and from Franconia, and Franconia is very near a place that still is in my white whale category, which is the Zoigel breweries. Uh-huh. near Franconia, where they make their crazy beer. It's communal brewing, and they have these ancient old breweries that are wood fired, and they have cool ships, and the people sell the beer out of their houses. So despite the fact that these styles are hundreds of years old, and despite the fact that modern brewing is so industrial and so modern and seems so ubiquitous, these little breweries managed to survive, and these traditions survived, and they become, for me as a writer, one of the most important pieces of the whole picture in terms of interest for me, but also just, I think when you want to talk about how broad beer is as a category.
Yeah. And when you think about beer as an expression of culture too.
Yeah.
Going back to these old breweries, you can see where it came from, the history and the evolution of it and the culture. Hey, cheers.
Cheers
the first one. Cheers this one.
And, you know, and to this day, lambics are so weird. They are just, you can't imagine they exist.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love them. I absolutely love them. I think there's not many of us out there who do, which is why these breweries never have to get very big. But there's something else. So this beer is, if you've listened to 194 episodes of this show and you haven't tasted lambic, you really got to do it for us.
Wow, this one's really good too.
They're really characterized by the Brettanomyces that mm-hmm. that are native there, and it's really distinctive. It does not smell like the, if you do an American wild ale, if they do it in America,
yeah,
there's a quality of the nose. It's a very animal-like quality. Mm-hmm. That thing that Michael Jackson used to call horse blanket and barnyard.
Right.
I don't know what the hell a horse blanket smells like, but it smells very paddocky and barny.
Yeah.
And they don't all, but Belgium really does. And
yeah.
Yeah, I could tell in a blind tasting, I could always pick out a Belgian because the flora or fauna or whatever those things are. What is fungus? Whatever fungus is. It's so distinctive there.
Yeah. I mean, I think the trick is to be able to express it but without being objectionable. And that's what the good ones do really well.
That was another huge discovery I made. So we did that tour in 2011. Mm-hmm. And wild beer had existed for a while in America, but it wasn't really very accomplished. And Americans were taking the IBU approach to it, sour ales, and trying to make them ultra, ultra sour. And a beer like this, is one of the reasons this is one of my favorites, is the acidity is quite restrained.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Belgium, I realized, oh, you shouldn't be punishing. The idea is not to...
It is like the old IPA.
Yeah.
Oh, my fate... face shouldn't necessarily be melting. I can enjoy an IPA without actually losing my tongue after one sip.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is very refined, given that it's a wild ale and it does express the Brettanomyces, but they've been able to turn it into something really, really quite remarkable.
And, you get all that. There's a dry bitterness that comes from the way these beers finish out. There's a cellar quality. There's compost. There are esters.
There are esters that, in this case, they to me right now they're expressing very fruity, very but bright fruity.
Yeah, yeah.
Not as much stone fruity.
Yeah, almost citrusy.
Citrusy, exactly. Yeah. I wasn't sure whether to go that far, but yeah, I would.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it does sort of lemony, orangey.
Mm-hmm.
This one's kind of. I've never had this. This is a good choice.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I in 2019, mm-hmm. I tried to go to this brewery. I did not have a car, and there was a bus, and I went to the bus station, and I waited at the bus station for about 2 hours, and the bus never came, and I finally went in, and there was a small sign in Dutch, I think. I don't think it was even French. Which said that bus was not running that day. So I did not get to make it. And somebody said, oh yeah, that bus is not running today.
Never runs.
So I went to Cantillon instead. The bus station was pretty close to Cantillon, which was fine.
Not a bad second.
Exactly. So one day I'll make it to this brewery.
Yeah, I was going to say that one of the reasons for the Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, because it sort of evoked to me this era when we started to homebrew, that the homebrewing itself was a revelation in terms of learning to understand and enjoy beer in a different level.
Yeah.
And so we've said this in the past, but if you're interested in beer and you like it and you're enthusiastic about it, it really doesn't take much equipment, and it's definitely worth giving it a try, even if just to have fun for a couple times and see what comes out.
I think the people who try to get into homebrewing because they want to make better beer than they can buy are going to be disappointed.
Yeah. Disabuse yourself of that notion right away, especially these days when craft beer is so exceptional.
Yeah, but it's like bread. You know, people continue to make bread even though you can get exceptional bread at the grocery store.
And you really get to understand the ingredients, what ingredients do to flavor, understand what fermentation does.
Process, length
of fermentation. You'll probably, if you're doing it for the first few times, learn what sanitation does. If you're not careful, get some off flavors.
Yeah, you probably will. And then you'll respect professional breweries more because they don't have those off flavors.
So when you have a beer like this that's using spontaneous fermentation, yet is so incredibly refined and so easy to drink. That's the dog of the pod, by the way. What's the dog doing?
The dog has found some recycling. So
nice.
The dog is eating plastic.
Yum.
Fortunately, I'm happy to say the dog of the pod tears stuff apart but does not swallow. So I'm not actually too concerned
about
this. That's
good. That might save you a trip to the vet.
Yeah.
Okay, so my next beer. And by the way, I cheated. We were supposed to do three beers each. I actually have four. But my next beer I got...
There's a lesson there, I think, somehow. In beer.
About cheating.
All rules are meant to be broken.
You know, another reason why it seemed appropriate to maybe end the pod now is I honestly am not drinking much beer at all these days, although I hope that changes, because I basically only drink beer when I go out these days, and I just don't go out that much.
You know, you should get a puppy.
I can bring it to pubs. Yeah, and you can tell me what good beer is, high dog.
And I think also that puppy will get you anxious enough chasing that puppy around all day. You want a beer at the end of the day.
So you've already mentioned this, but this beer speaks to me in two ways. So this is Fuller's London Pride. We've talked about it a lot on the pod.
If we had a mascot beer, this would probably be it.
One, because it's the English tradition, that's how it kind of all started for us. The early craft beers were often English ales. It's an expression of the English heritage that I have and beers that I adore. But also, it reminds me of our trip in 2011, you said it was? Mm-hmm. So when you were researching the First Beer Bible, you had to go all around Europe.
Right.
I joined you for the Britain part. And to this day, that still remains incredibly memorable. Oh, he's going after the microphone that we couldn't hook up. He wants an extra mic so she can join the pod.
Yes.
So I joined you for that trip. It was an incredibly memorable trip. It was the first time I got a chance to... I'd visited a little bit of craft breweries around Oregon, I think, by that point, but never these old traditional breweries around England, the literally centuries of tradition that they represent. We visited the Griffin Brewery, the Fuller's Brewery in Chiswick in London.
It was the first brewery that I did for the Beer Bible, too, so it's also extremely memorable for me.
Yeah, it was our very first trip. We were treated exceptionally well by John Keeling, who was the head brewer there at the time. He served us London Pride and lunch.
And his good sidekick, who had just come over from Young's, Derek Prentice.
Derek Prentice, yeah.
So,
yeah. So this beer evokes lots of things to me, but those are the two main ones. Just the early craft beer tradition, sort of where it came from, although a lot of American hops were added on top. and that trip. So cheers.
Yeah, cheers. I like would just echo all of that. I will say also, in our homebrewing time, now there's so many different yeast labs that I can't give you the names and numbers of all the yeast labs, but the Fuller strain is pretty well known in Weiss. It's 1968, and we would brew with that quite a bit.
1968, yep. That's the one.
It has a lot, with also the year of our birth.
Yes.
It has a lot of character, which is just... so Fuller's-y. It just really tastes like Fuller's.
So our early home brews tasted just like this. Well, I mean, in that sense, the yeast profile did. And we brewed something not too dissimilar to this with a bunch of Cascade hops on top and called it our dark IPA.
It worked pretty well, actually. Mm-hmm. This, that's how Hazy's got started. Somebody recognized, and it, you know, what didn't actually start in New England, but people recognized that those yeast esters that taste so fruity work really well with the hops that also taste very fruity.
Yeah. So. And this to me is just the taste of England now. And when I go back and visit my mother and my sister, who I do fairly frequently now,
right?
I always, luckily the local pub to my mother is a Fuller's pub, so I can go in and have a few pints of London Pride. And
yeah, we should give a shout out to our friend John Urch, friend of the pod, Londoner who also goes back, and so whenever you or John are in London, you text me photos of
the beers.
London Pride, drinking London Pride. So he also grew up on London Pride. So I suspect there are a lot of people who have it's the city beer of London. So that's a pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, and you can get it here. I bought a bottle, and actually, this is not bad. This is in pretty good shape.
It is,
but it's just. Particularly one of those you want to drink in situ, you know, doesn't travel as well, and it's not quite the same as you get in the pub, especially not from a nice cask engine.
Exactly. I think that's the biggest difference. It's not particularly oxidized. I feel like the hops are a little subdued, and if it were fresh on cask, served from a good pint, you know, it would be superior, obviously, but it's not bad.
No, actually.
I was really expecting the worst.
Yeah, I had hope because it looked like they had just stocked up the fridge, and it was refrigerated too. So, yeah, so that beer spoke to me, and that's why.
Yeah, that I went to, so you went to John's Marketplace here in town, and I went to Belmont Station. I actually looked for London Pride, and I don't think they carry it.
Oh, really? Well, I got lucky then.
Yeah,
I thought I was gonna have to get an ESB, which is fine. That was one of the things we. One of those great experiences I learned about Party Guile Brewing. I saw the big vats and how they blend them turns into either London Pride or ESB or...
Which is a nice shout because our very first podcast was about Party Guile Brewing.
Was it?
If you go back to pod number one,
Party Guile Brewing. Wow, excellent. Good memory. That's right.
I believe it was a crude pod. It was like 13 minutes or something and...
You know. The audio.
Yeah.
Always bad, but particularly bad back in those days.
Yeah, it was like from another century, but it wasn't actually that long ago.
Yeah. So that was really fun. The brewery's still there. They're still making beer. They're owned by Kirin Asahi, one of those.
A Japanese company?
Japanese beer company. But they seem to be going strong, and yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's Asahi, but I don't know.
I think that's right. Yeah.
No. Sue us.
Yeah, what are we gonna do?
Yeah, we need to shut down the pod.
You're really gonna start fact checking? Good luck with that.
Yes, there's that 95% accuracy.
Yeah, give or take.
Mm. Very nice. Yeah, very nice. All right. Would like to. Yeah. One of the things that the way I thought of this was partly. My life has been blessed by being able to travel quite a bit, and a lot of the beers that we have here connect me to a place and a time, which I think is beer's mm-hmm. great.
Exactly.
Temporal and space, time and space mm-hmm. capacity. So I feel I would love to be... In a pub like the Jack Horner, which was the very first London pub we went to. We had just gotten into town and we went to a Fuller's pub, and that particular pub sold pies, and we met your sister.
It was around the corner of my sister's architecture program, and
I think we might have had Chiswick's that night, or we at least we started with Chiswick's and then we went to London Pride.
Yeah, maybe even ended up at a Bengal Tiger, but
yeah.
But yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Shout out to my sister who's just about to give birth to her second child.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Raise a glass to her. But I agree. When you drink a beer, it activates certain senses, and that can take you to a place and a time, and so that's what London Pride does to me. I can have a London Pride here in the States, and it immediately transports me back to London with my family or with you. That's part of what's really nice.
Hand me that bottle opener.
Yes, sir. Let's go.
All right. So speaking of a time and a place.
I'm going to go very Jeffy now. Let's see.
We're going to go to Bomberg because we got to go to Bomberg.
Lovely. This is what you're going to eat. Well done.
So this is, I'll let you pour as much as you wish. This is Schlenkerla, no surprise. And this is a new beer to them called Erle, I'm going to say. E-R-L-E. Is it L-E or L-A?
L-E.
Yeah. And it is, so Schlenkerla is, of course, the classic Raukbier brewery.
Yeah.
This is a little bit of a new beer. I could have gotten their classic Märzen. But I've had this recently, so I decided to mix it up because I knew you wouldn't have had this beer.
That's correct. I have not.
It's only 4.2%. It's a Schatz beer,
mm-hmm.
but it's smoked, and it really knocked my socks off. So
It is smoked. It smells like a sausage.
Mm. It is, but it's more I was going to say it's more lightly smoked than you would expect. I think once you have a few drinks, it'll feel more lightly smoked. It's pretty smoky.
But it's nice. It's not, I don't even know how to describe the smoke that kind of sort of smacks you in the face. This is smoke that kind of,
it's an interesting,
kind of, I don't know, wraps you up like a warm blanket.
It does. Like, yeah, it's more campfire-y than hammy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's, yeah, it's warming. I think it does a cool thing because it's a Schwarz beer, so it's got some roasted malts in there. So the roast and the smoke work well together. They play nicely together and give you a slightly different flavor. The reason I chose Swinkla is because the pub where the everybody thinks of as Schlenkerla. Mm-hmm. It's not actually where the brewery is located. The brewery is a couple of blocks away. That pub is 600 years old. And when you walk into that place, and it's in the old town of Bamberg, the entire old town is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's perfectly preserved. It was not bombed during World War II, I think because it was too remote and too small. Mm-hmm. So the downtown area, or the old town area, is basically, it's like a movie set from hundreds of years ago.
Right.
And this 600-year-old pub feels like it has not changed in 600 years. And it is literally my favorite pub in the world. If I could ever be teleported to go to a place and have a pint, that would be on my short list. It is just the coolest place ever. It's just a pub. It's not special in that way, but right. That's what makes it special.
Add that to my bucket list.
Yeah. Yeah.
This, it's going to sound ridiculous or maybe obvious, but you know, a plate of Würstenkraut would be amazing with this beer.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It has this amazing rib sticking Franconian fare, mm-hmm. including, a dish that Sally got, which I did not get, and I must go back just so I can get it, which is the Bamberg onion, mm-hmm. which is an onion hollowed out and filled with some kind of pork, I think, mm-hmm. and then, I don't know, baked or roasted or some, I don't know.
Right.
It was awesome. I got it one bite, and I got sausage, which was delightful, but I regretted never getting that Bamberg onion.
Yeah.
And we went back for another pint, but it wasn't dinner time, so I didn't get my Bamberg onion. So that has been in the back of my head. Got to go back for that Bamberg onion.
All right. Well, we can make a date.
Yeah.
We'll go to Bamberg, and we'll have an onion and some Schwarz beer.
Yeah. I think anybody who goes to Oktoberfest should buy a train ticket and go up for a day or two to Bamberg.
How far? By train?
It's not far. It's, you know, an hour or two.
Yeah.
Not far.
Easy train ride.
It's an easy train ride. You could even do it in one day, mm-hmm. if the trains worked out and everything. It's not too far. Don't do it in one day.
It's worth more than a day.
Yeah, Bamberg
more
is
than a night.
Amazing little village that is just absolutely gorgeous. Medieval nice. Village. So
awesome.
Yeah. So and then shout out to Matthias Trum, who gave me his family who owns it. He was still in his late 30s, I think, when I met him in 2012, mm-hmm. which puts him probably pushing 50 now. So he's no longer the young kid. he had young kids then who are now probably in high school or maybe even college. But he was one of the great experiences of my life as a beer writer is meeting the owners or the brewers at these places. And you mentioned John Keeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I could just tick through some of the great people I've met, and Matthias Trum is certainly one of those people.
And the brewers at these old places, the European brewers, are so connected to the whole history of what they're doing. So it's not, you know, both are great, but it's a super fascinating to talk to an American craft brewer who's unconnected, who's free, liberated from any tradition, right. and basically free to sort of explore however they want, blend traditions, mishmat, you know, try something new. But then it's equally impressive to see someone like a John Keeling who knows that he's got hundreds of years of history that he needs to maintain. At the same time, he also needs to meet the modern marketplace, and it's a fascinating, to me, it's just a fascinating position to be in.
And to that point, Matthias Trum was the person who told me that, so as late as 2012 when I visited there, I forwarded the idea that people did not know about yeast until Pasteur, which in a narrow sense, that's true.
Right.
But
didn't understand yeast in the scientific sense.
Exactly. But that's not the story that we laundered to each other. We right. said they didn't even know it existed.
Right.
And he said, oh, no, that's totally wrong. You're crazy. I've heard that. But in medieval times, there was a guild, the Hafner Guild. Mm. And if you were a Hafner, you were the yeast guy.
Right.
So you were the person who picked the barm up after the thing, and you would press it.
Uh-huh.
And when you pressed it, you get this weird like dregs of beer that would come out, uh-huh. and you'd sell that to the poor. and then you took care of the yeast, so that the next pitching, right. you know, you were the guy who took care of the yeast.
Right.
And I said, and something in that moment, I felt so embarrassed as a writer. You become familiar with the experience of embarrassment because you realize that you were.
What you thought you knew, you didn't actually know everything.
Exactly. And I said, oh, God, of course. I'm a home brewer. I know that when you finish brewing a batch of beer in the carboy, there's a bunch of stuff there. And he said, zoig, zoig. Yeah, it means stuff. That's what they called it, zoig.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
He's a very, very gracious, very cool guy.
Awesome. Well, I am very much enjoying this beer, and I'm not a smoked beer kind of guy. I think I've been ruined by American craft beer brewers who smack you in the face.
Yeah.
And then this kind of smoke is very rich, deep, and kind of lush and lovely.
Totally. Yeah, Schlenkerlo's.
You've brought me along, Jeff.
Yeah, it's the stuff.
Okay. I am now going to bring my next beer out. I'm trying to think of what the appropriate gap glassware is for this. Probably the same thing, but... this is Zeugelhaus, Portland's Zeugelhaus, Zeugel Pils, and
nice.
This is meaningful for a number of reasons, not the least of which because Alan Taylor is maybe the greatest of many great friends of the pod.
Yeah.
Alan Taylor is probably the greatest friend of the pod. Alan Taylor's kids in particular, hi. in doing this pod, I've met a lot of people in the beer industry, never met a bad one. I don't know. I'm trying to pick my words carefully. Kind of asshole-free for the most part industry. And most of them are incredibly gracious, humble, interesting folks who are just attracted to this crazy craft of sort of art and industry.
Yeah.
And Alan's a perfect example of that. What a interesting person. What a great gentleman. So that's part of it. So that one of the reasons I chose this is because it just sort of represents all of the wonderful craft brewers I've met, all the people in the industry I've met, you know, hop growers and distributors, and I don't know, we've talked to lots of different people, yeast cultivators.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. The other thing is, and this is going to be super cliche, but I don't know how else to say it. I think after you've gone through this huge journey of beer, you end up at Pilsner.
Yeah.
Like, you just do. I mean, it's almost the pinnacle of the brewer's art. And it's simple and elegant and amazing. And Alan makes an amazing one. Perhaps my favorite, which is a little bit hoppier, so Northern German style. And that's what Zeugel Pils is. So let's try.
Yeah, Alan still gives us hell because it
didn't end up first in our...
Yeah, exactly. And Sally, who came in for the finals, tasted it and she said, that's the best one. And Alan has always remembered that Sally liked Zeugel Pils better.
Oh, does he remember that?
Oh, yes.
Good for Sally. Well, I have to say...
And he calls her the better half for very specific and defensive reasons, which if I were him, I would
too. We had three finalists, all of which... were exceptional, all of which had their own characters.
Yes.
We had the Wayfinder CZAF.
Yep.
Which was a very rustic, traditional Czech Pilsner.
Yeah.
We had the Crux.
Well, Crux, yeah. That's...
Which I still love the Crux as well.
The surprise.
It's a nice bookend to the Zeugelhaus in the sense that it's kind of a German Pilsner, right. Very bright, very light. But very sort of lemony, lemongrassy, bright citrusy. And this one's more of a hop forward version. But all three were amazing. And this one, I think, over time is the one I grab the most.
I will confess, it's the one I grab the most too. Yeah. And there is something quenching in the hopping, which is quite bitter at the front.
Yeah.
But by the time you're 2/3 of the way through one beer, you feel like you don't want to stop drinking this beer. And it is, this is a reason why I no longer drink beers in small quantities. I feel like you need to, you need to assess a beer at, you know, at least 12 ounces. And those beers that continue to improve after two or three, those are impressive beers. And Zweigelhaus, that's
a lesson you taught me long ago. And this is actually a good thing to mention the very last podcast, is that, you know, tasters can be fun. I do it every once in a while when I'm just really...
Yeah, I don't have anything against them.
But if you really want to get to know a beer, you gotta sit with it for a while. You gotta have a decent quantity of it. So, this represents sort of a lot of what this podcast has brought to me. It's a lot of the human relationships that we've built through this whole process. It's getting to know the human side of all this, of beer, and also sort of just we've told the story before, but a long time ago. So I'll tell it again, which is, you and I decided to brew a Pilsner.
Yes.
And we're not the best brewers, let's just admit.
Yeah.
But we're earnest.
Yeah.
We try hard.
Yeah.
And this was probably the best beer we've ever brewed.
And it was the first lager we ever made.
First lager we ever made. We just nailed it. It was exceptional. It's my favorite beer we've ever brewed.
100%.
And we were so proud.
Yeah.
And Alan,
and we're like... We got it, man.
Yeah, like Pilsner.
What the hell?
Pilsner straightforward. You can knock this out of the park, no problem. And I think it was Alan who said, oh, that's great. Now do it again.
Yeah.
And we never got anywhere close. We
needed to mic drop and say, nope, we're done.
It was that magic moment where he just happened to do it. But the whole point of being a commercial brewer is being able to be consistent time and time again, brew the same exceptional beer. We never were able to recreate it. And it was a humbling experience. It was great to have brewed that beer once. Also, incredibly humbling to realize we just could not, for the life of us, recreate it. And so Pilsner to me is just like the pinnacle of the brewer's art. And if you can make a good Pilsner, then that's how I sort of, okay, you're a good brewer.
Yeah.
I know it's cliche, but it's one of those cliches that are just based in truth.
I don't punish, especially an American brewer that doesn't make an exceptional Pilsner or a Helles. I would accept Helles in that category too.
Sure. Yeah.
But I usually start with those beers, and if they're really good, then I'm impressed.
Yeah.
If they're an IPA brewery and they've decided to put a Helles or a Pilsner on just for fans, and that they're not that great, but their IPAs are awesome, it's like, this is fine. I'm not going to hold it against you. But on the other hand, if you impress me with your Pilsner, you're really impressed.
Yeah. And I'm an old man, so I always start with low alcohol beers, and usually that's, and if they have a Pilsner or a Helles, I'll almost always start with that. And so it's a good introduction to the brewer. And I get it that if you're a brewer, you kind of, and you want to brew one of these beers, you sort of want to do something a little distinctive. And so sometimes, you know, for me, that kind of gets in the way of just brewing a straightforward Pilsner that's just good.
Totally.
But this is just kind of the best of the best. And so that's why this beer spoke to me, and I'm super enjoying drinking this right now. I've really my beer journey went from, you know, super heavy, bitter IPAs to now what I consider sort of very subtle, refined, lower alcohol, delightful beers like this.
Yeah. On the point of friends / people we admire in the industry, it's been an interesting, since this is the last podcast, as a writer, it's always been kind of an interesting thing for me to cover beer, because I do have people I admire in the industry, and I have grown to have people I consider friends. Sometimes I've only met them briefly, like in a recent podcast you heard an interview that we had with Marek Kaminski, a Polish brewer, and I feel like in the brief period of time I knew Marek, I would consider him a friend. You know, if I saw him again, I would be delighted to see him, and I feel like we could go anywhere and hang out and have fun. And it's been interesting because I am kind of a journalist and I should have some distance. But with people who do a craft like this, when you see them do something extremely well and they're good people, it's very hard to have that separation. And I've always felt slightly embarrassed that I'm not a, you know, a cigar chomping jerk who is always looking for a better story and like looking for the dirty underbelly of the beer industry. But you know somebody. I appreciate that you brought one of Alan's beers here, and we could have brought a Gigantic. We've had Ben Havig on. We've had Ben Edmonds on. We've had just a number of wonderful people on that would fit the same, you know, their shoe would fit in the Cinderella's slipper. But he's a really good example of the kind of people that I've been really happy to know. It's made my life more enriched, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that, because that's actually a point I wanted to make. I sat there deciding among all of the wonderful pilsners and just in wonderful beers that represented this aspect of the people I've met. So yes, Ben Edmonds at Breakside, Tobias Hahn at Rosenstadt, Van Havig at Gigantic, and on and on and on. We've met just so many great people. And the other thing to say is that with very few exceptions, nobody's getting rich in craft beer.
Right.
They're doing it because they love it. They're doing it because it's a passion. A lot of them are home brewers, started off as home brewers, got really interested in beer and made a profession out of it. So these are, you know, humble people, just really salt of the earth, great people. And it's been also really wonderful to see all of the growing diversity in craft beer. So all the female brewers, I saw on your Twitter feed, probably. We're not supposed to call it Twitter, whatever.
Yeah, well, we can call it Twitter.
Elon Musk. Exactly. Elon Musk.
Screw Elon Musk, I'm going to say right here.
But you have to remember, you have to remind me which...
Whitney Burnside?
Who's Whitney Burnside. Okay,
She won 3 gold medals. Yeah. I think they won... I think her brewery, Grand Fur, won 4 medals at the recent Oregon Beer Awards. And I think... I'm pretty sure you can check my work. It's on the blog. 3 of them were gold, which is really impressive because she's got a brew pub. She's brewing...
Well, I think it's something that the Oregon craft beer community can be proud of, that we created a space where... not just white bearded men.
and a woman we've never had Whitney on. You know, if we continued to do this, we would have Whitney on. We would also, another alum of 10 Barrel Brewing is Tanya Cornett, who this year won the Sharer Award, which is basically like the Lifetime Achievement Award that the Brewers Association gives out. And they started that in 1997. So you can do the quick math. It's fewer than 30 years. 5 of them have been Oregonians, and we've had 2 Oregonians in a row. So Tanya Cornett, who is the R&D brewer for 10 Barrel in Bend, won it this year, and last year Ben Edmonds won it. So we have, and actually when I get to my next beer, we're gonna keep talking about this, but Oregon is really knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, well, let's keep talking and keep drinking.
All right.
Well, why don't you introduce that beer? I was also going to throw in a shout out to Alex Genoon, who's super influential to both of us, I think, in the way we think about beer, the way we think about people who brew beer, the way everything. So, but go ahead. Let's talk about this first.
Alex Genoon Upright, which just celebrated its 15th anniversary, which
amazing,
makes
wonderful,
me feels like crazy old, because that
Alex
feels like such a fresh and new brewery. When he emailed me recently and said, "Hey, do you want to know a story on my 15th anniversary?" I was like, "No, because that can't be."
You're lying.
You're lying. but you're right. Alex is spectacular. Okay.
All right. So what do we have?
So this next one, I'm going to use. This is a beer I've never had before.
Excellent. Let's go. That's a good. I like that.
Yeah, but it's from Block 15, a brewery that fits into this category of breweries we're talking about. And it's actually, I was speaking to Nick, and I'll tell you in a minute why, but he mentioned that they started a new program where they're doing American-style IPAs. I think you're going to like this.
So this is Nick Arzner of Block 15 Brewing in Corvallis, Oregon.
Right.
Just to set
It's called their Emerging Series.
Okay.
And it's described as Pacific Northwest hops and Southern Hemisphere hops.
Ooh.
So this one is
I'm
for
gonna
you.
I like this. Exactly. Yes, exactly.
so this is sort of more I Block 15 is really famous for their Sticky Hands, which is a double IPA,
yeah.
and then a kind of a series of hazies they've been doing. But this is more back to like Northwest roots, and you can tell by the color and the clarity that it's sort of an old school meets new school.
Slightly darker. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Ooh, man, that smells good.
So, IPA on the nose.
One of the reasons I chose this is I looked at the I looked at the can, and it was canned 3 weeks ago. So I'm like, all right, this is going to be awesome.
Yeah, so this is just like a balm on the nose.
It's
got tropical flavors. It's got citrus. It has...
got a little piney dank.
Tiny bit
there.
Of pine, yeah. Yes. And it's got this, it's a beautiful color. It's slightly darker than a modern one, so it's not just straw, but a little bit amber.
Yep.
But I'm glad you got an IPA, because that was the one. I already cheated by getting a fourth beer.
Right.
But I didn't get an IPA, which is crazy, because IPA is sort of what beer is to our generation of craft beer drinkers.
It is. And it's our heritage here in Oregon, which allows me to talk about a project that I mentioned on the blog, so it's probably not news to anyone else.
Let's go.
One of the reasons why this makes sense for me not to be doing this podcast anymore is because I have just launched a project. Ooh, Patrick's making a very happy face.
Oh, that's such a good IPA. That's such a good IPA. Oh, it's called Rocky... Did you say it? It's called Rocky Shores.
Mm.
American IPA. And it has an old... International Harvester, what did they call these? Scout.
Scout. Oh, man. Good shout. Look at that brain cell firing.
Every once in a while, there's a synapse that just fires. Don't know why, don't know how. Nice. I welcome it.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. Rocky Shores. Yeah. It really, it actually has a slight quality. I don't know if Nick, he didn't mention this in the email that he sent me, but... It reminds me a little bit of a Pelican beer, and I wonder if it was a little wink and a nod to Darren Welch, who was this year's at the OBA, this was this year's Hall of Fame inductee.
Yeah.
So, I'm gonna say that's in the mix. Just I'm gonna say it's a slight homage to Darren Welch.
It is an amazing blend of old and new.
I got this partly because the story of my beer adventure is I love these places I've been to, and I love revisiting them and living the past. But I also really love the beer world because it's always changing and there's always something new to try. And Oregon IPA is something I drink a lot of. Mm-hmm. And I am starting a project to promote Oregon beer.
Yeah, this is exciting. Tell us about it, Jeff.
Yes. So... almost a year ago, I pitched Travel Oregon on the idea of boosting their coverage of beer because it's abysmal. Mm-hmm. It's very out of date and it's scant. And neither they nor Travel Oregon was interested in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So long story short, I decided to do a project to promote it myself and found a nonprofit that's devoted to promoting Oregon beer. Today, I had my first meeting with the board of directors, the newly installed board of directors of what we're calling Celebrate Oregon Beer.
I was about to say, don't bury the lead. What's it called? Celebrate Oregon Beer.
The thing is, I think Celebrate Oregon Beer is going to be the parent company, and that's the name that we have. But as it exists, when you see it, it will just be a celebration of Oregon beer. And we won't really talk about the parent nonprofit. It'll mostly be about trying to draw attention to not just Oregon beer, but also Oregon hops, which mm-hmm. have their own native terroir, which if you saw a recent blog post I did, it's quite different from Idaho and Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I have support both from the Oregon Brewers Guild and the Oregon Hops Commission, who support this project, which I'm excited about. We have 30... Ooh, I have to look at the... I don't have the list right in front of me. I think 33... donors who are pledged donors who will help establish this nonprofit.
Uh-huh.
And then going forward, we're going to have a robust website. So if you're in, I don't know, Astoria, Oregon, and you have a dog and a child and you want a meal and you want to know what breweries around you fit all those criteria, you can just go and plug that in. You'll find it. That does not exist right now. Mm-hmm. Accurate, up-to-date information about the breweries that exist in Portland or in Oregon does not exist anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So like that's number one, we're going to promote fresh hops, which is something you and I have talked about a lot.
Yep.
I really want to get more. I feel like the fresh hop season in the Pacific Northwest is one of the best things that happens in the beer world. Almost no one has experienced it who lives outside the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. That's a travesty. I would love, if I don't know if Governor Kotag is listening, but if you are, I would love to do what they do in the Beaujolais region, where they have Beaujolais Day. We'll have Fresh Hop Day. Maybe we'll get Governor Kotag out to clip a bine, and we'll kick off Fresh Hop season, something like that. Mm-hmm. We'll have some fun. We'll do some events. We'll do some collaborations. I'm pretty excited to do this. It's going to take a lot of my time, it's an adventure that's just starting. So it's going to, you know, it's kind of my new thing. And by chance, Nick Arzner, who owns and was the original head brewer, I think he probably, his brewing days are probably more attenuated now that he's, mm-hmm. you know, 15 years in or whatever. anyway, he is the president of the new board of Celebrate Oregon Beer. So thank you, Nick.
That's fantastic. Congratulations, Nick. Congratulations, you, Jeff. I can't think of a better person than Nick to help out.
Exactly. Yeah. So we have a great team. And Gail Goshi is the hop grower who was on the board. I'm excited to have hop growers, and I'm excited to be, going into the world of hops. We have a friend of the pod, Max Coleman, mm-hmm. Who I'm going to give a shout out here. He's also been one of the great listeners of this podcast. I think we're going to have a great relationship with some hop growers, and I'm looking forward to working with folks like Max and Gail and others in this project as well. So I'm very excited to go forward with this. And I, for the first time, I don't have to be an objective, beer writer who was like, well, there are many fine states, and Ohio beer is just as good as Oregon. Now I can say that's crap. Obviously, Oregon beer is way better than Ohio beer. So sorry, Ohio. I'm sorry. You have good beer, but we have better. That's the thing I'm gonna love doing is just saying we have the best beer.
Yeah, behind the scenes, we've discussed this a bit in the past, and I'm really excited that it's finally off the ground and you're doing this. I think it's great. I think it's fantastic. And I do think that Travel Oregon missed the boat, because this is a big reason why people might come to the state and travel around and get to know the state. And it's one of the funnest parts for me of just traveling around the state, is because there's great beer and it's different in different places, and you can see great towns, great beer, go to the hop fields,
it's amazing. It's amazing. And the truth is, one of the reasons that to tie into our program here today, one of the reasons I wanted to pitch this in the first place was because there are not very many places in the world where you have the richness of beer culture that you have in Oregon, where you have things like hop fields. Mm-hmm. Everybody in America now has a lot of breweries, and almost everybody has a lot of really good breweries, but there's more to the brewing industry than just good breweries. There are things like, do you have hop fields? Do you have barley fields? Do you have malt houses? Do you have hop breeding programs? Do you have, research programs mm-hmm. into beer? Do you have brewing schools? On and on and on. When you start narrowing it down and looking at the places that have all those, you're talking about certain places in the UK, Belgium, Bohemia, Bavaria, mm-hmm. and not very many other places.
Right.
Oregon has all of that. Yeah. And I think almost nobody in the world recognizes that or understands it. And that's a failure of communication. And that's something we can fix. So nice. That's what I want to do.
Excellent. There are two things I want to say about your choice here, because it's Block 15 and Nick Arzner. Mm-hmm. And I just want to shout.
It does kick some booty too. Yeah. And this beer is awesome.
It's an excellent beer. And it's amazing because it's, as I said, it's a mix of old and new. Well, let me back up and just say IPA was obviously maybe the seminal moment in our craft brewing lives when IPAs came out and really expressed these hops and these local Oregon native hops. It was just a revelation, because all of the beer we'd been drinking up to that point was basically suppressing hops and meant to.
And in our lifetime, those kinds of beers have taken over the world. Like American IPAs are made in Mexico City.
Oh yeah.
And Prague. Exactly. And,
London.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. So it's, so just that's why I was really glad you got an IPA and I didn't. I decided that my pale ale would have to do because it's kind of the beer that American craft beer was built on.
Totally.
It wouldn't exist. We probably wouldn't be here unless IPA came about and people really started going running with the idea of IPA and turning it into something entirely American and unique.
And I feel like California has really done a good job of stealing the narrative and saying that they invented IPAs. And the truth is, that's not actually the case. Yeah. The Pacific Northwest, everything, Chico North is where IPA got started. Yeah. And, you know, there was a full-time, year-round IPA being brewed in the Pacific Northwest. And by 1985 in Portland, which was Grant's IPA, which was contract brewed at Portland Brewing, which had a huge influence on a bunch of breweries around town. And so, you know, by the mid to late 1980s, IPAs were so common that everybody in the Pacific Northwest knew what they were. When we got to Madison, Wisconsin in 1992, we wanted to brew beer. We were thinking IPAs. I mean, you know, this is a thing that goes back a long time in this region. So it is really our native style. And when you look at these other places that I ticked off, they all have their own native styles. Well, we do too.
Yeah.
And it's why I selected this beer. Yeah, Rocky Shores from Block 15.
And it's truly the first beer style that I ever, you know, fell in love with, right? Like, fun. Like, oh my gosh. An early craft beer in Oregon, at least, well, I remember Full Sail Amber, which was a fine beer, but it wasn't until really that hop, just that saturated hop flavor came about that my mind was finally blown.
Totally.
The other thing I wanted to say about Nick Arzner and Block 15 was it was also a seminal moment for me because we went and visited Nick when he was starting off his barrel aging program. And I had never really thought or appreciated the whole process of blending.
Right.
And he took us through this amazing sort of...
Where he was making lambic-style beers.
Yeah, he was making lambic-style beers. They were installing a cool ship. And he had this barrel-age program. And then it was the first time I sort of appreciated that part of the brewer's art. It's taking all of these different barrels that have these different characteristics. And you can't always control them. But what you can control is how you blend them together and create something out of it. My mind was blown and it was amazing. And it was just in the basement of this little, you know, his little pub in downtown Corvallis.
Yeah.
I just wanted to relate that. This another one of those amazing moments that this whole podcast and being associated with you has brought me. So that was really fun. And thanks, Nick.
Yeah. 100%.
All right. Well,
speaking of, great beer, let's go on a high note.
Okay, so yeah, and that's basically what my last beer is all about. I was thinking about, like, and we've talked about this before, what would be sort of the one beer if you could have only one, or I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but this is Saison DuPont.
Yeah.
And for me, it's kind of like...
It was on the show when you mentioned that this was one of your favorites, and you're not... really a Belgian guy, and it was so shocking to me that you would say Saison DuPont.
You're the one who got me into Belgian beers. But this is a beer that kind of, for me, represents everything. It's a quaffable beer. You can have it any season. It's approachable but complex. I could go on and on and on. One thing, by the way, I got this in a can.
Mm-hmm.
And
is a change.
Yeah, we were talking about this. They did have a big corked bottle. What is it, 750 milliliter? I don't know what the big one is.
Yeah, they had different sizes, actually. So they had the 750, which I think was the classic. But they did actually have like a little guy.
They had a smaller one, and I was looking for that.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I should probably just buy the 750, but because you made the point, which is in the can, they probably can't have the same carbonation because it's too much pressure.
Yeah.
So we'll see how this goes. But... So this is a Belgian farmhouse ale. It's
the Belgian farmhouse ale.
The Belgian farmhouse ale. It's just, to me, it's like when you think about beer and you think about everything that it represents, to me, this is sort of like the gold standard of everything. Like, it's a beer you want to drink. It's easily approachable. Everybody likes it, but it's also deep and complex. You could drink it for a long time and still be discovering things about it because it's so, I don't know. To me, it's just kind of like this miracle beer.
That's amazing.
So that's why I call it.
Yeah, when we started this podcast, you said at one point we should do an episode on Belgian beers because I don't understand them that much.
Yeah.
Which kind of shocked me because I think I'd already discovered that you like Saison DuPont so well, and it's like, well, you know, at the end of the Belgian path, there are two beers. There's Orval and Saison DuPont, and those are the great treasures. Maybe you're going to throw Westmalle triple in there as the third, the triple crown. But I was always shocked that it was like, well, if you understand Saison DuPont, you understand Belgian beer. Yeah. That's
you're right. But Saison DuPont in a can is different than Saison DuPont in a bottle.
It is.
So I would recommend getting the bottle. Still a great beer.
It is. The yeast character presents a little bit flatter.
Yeah, it really does.
And you know, everybody has to yield to commercial realities. So here is Saison DuPont in a can.
And if your Saison DuPont has been sitting around for a while, you probably want it from a can, right?
That's right. And also, if you're not buying beer that's in bottles because you're 30 years old and you've never bought a beer in a bottle, and what the right. hell would you ever buy a beer in a bottle? Yeah. This is probably still going to be a revelatory experience because it is still Saison yeast, the Saison DuPont yeast, which is... I mean, I toured this brewery and there were some things that I had read about breweries that I wanted to go to the breweries to see for myself. And one of the things that I had read about Saison DuPont or the DuPont brewery is that this yeast prefers temperatures above 90 degrees, which I don't know. Can you do the Celsius conversion quickly? What is that? That's like 35 or something.
Oh yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite hot. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not quite that. Maybe it's like 33. Maybe it's around 33.
Yeah.
And it can get up to blood temperature, and a little bit above, like fever blood temperature before this,
which is crazy.
Before you have to start cooling it down. And so when I went to the brewery, I was delighted to see that the old funky ass square, they had these cubic fermenters.
Uh-huh.
They were literally like cubes with rounded corners.
Right.
But it was a weird melange of modern and super antiquated equipment. And so they kept the equipment and the technology that was important to the flavor profile the same, but then things that were not, they changed. So they had a whole process of monitoring the temperature digitally.
Uh-huh.
And there was a readout. There was like a central readout, and it was connected to the fermenters, and you could see the temperatures. And yeah, and one of them was like 36 degrees or something. I don't know what it was. I can't remember exactly, but I went back, and it was over 100 degrees. It was fermenting at over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Which is insane.
I know. Those are some badass yeasts.
That's just insane. No other brewery in the world uses a yeast strain like that, with the possible exception of some of the Quake strains in Norway. But even, I mean, that's very hot and so weird. And to see that, I took a photo of it. And it's one of those winks, and I think I even put it in the beer Bible. It's one of those winks to nerds who just can't imagine that you would ferment that to even, you know, a typical good ale fermentation is going to be plus or minus 70 degrees.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're talking.
And lagering is much lower than that.
So this is just, it's just a weird ass brewery.
Yeah.
It makes weird beer.
I know. And that's the crazy thing about Saison DuPont is there's only one place that makes anything. I mean, this is it. Like, it's one brewery, it's one beer. I love it because it expresses all three. To me, you have the malt and the yeast and the hops. I mean, yeast is obviously the most prominent, but it's
pretty hoppy.
It's
pretty hoppy. Yeah. We did a tasting with my wife's staff for Christmas, and we got a Saison DuPont, and I got it because I wanted the yeast to come through because we did three different beers and this was my yeast beer. Mm-hmm. And it was so hoppy. I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot. It's really hoppy.
It's exactly.
I probably should have gotten a different beer.
It expresses the hops, expresses the yeast. I know that the malt is basically, you know, a blonde, a straw. But still, it's the base in which it's built. And it's got that sort of biscuity, almost Englishy malt character. And it's very dry.
Mm-hmm.
Which I really love. Dry, yeah, I really love the dry finish. And it's just a beer. Like, if there was one beer that I had to I had to live with for the rest of my life. This would be it because it's just so complex and yet so simple. I don't know. I could go on and on, but I decided this would be the beer I'd go out on because it's kind of the best in many ways.
I think everybody listening, and I maybe not, maybe they haven't listened as closely as I've listened because I've been sitting here next to you, but I would have guessed that you'd gone out on Fuller's London Pride. So I'm once again surprised and pleasurably so.
Yeah, well, I guess the difference is that this is a beer that's, I mean, London Pride is what it is, very proudly so. John Keeling talked about the relationship you build with a London Pride, that as you drink it, it changes, it becomes different. It, you know, each time you go to the pub, it might be slightly different, but it's still the same.
It's like your friend. He might have a haircut, but you still recognize him.
Exactly. And I love that. And I just love London Pride, for me, evokes that whole British pub culture and something familiar and welcoming and warming and lovely. And but what Saison DuPont to me represents is sort of everything that's wonderful about beer.
I don't think I've ever asked you this question, but do you recall the first time you tasted it? Is that an experience memorable to you?
London Pride?
No, Saison DuPont.
Oh, Saison DuPont. I first tasted it because you told me to.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And what I think my first impression was sort of, I was so surprised at how rich and complex it was, given that it presents as a straw.
Yeah, it looks like a regular beer.
Yeah.
And I mean, well, I don't have any of Alan's beer left, but they probably look just alike.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's not like those other Belgian beers, which are heavy and dark and super complex and stone fruit and stuff that, like, okay, I get it. Like, but this is something that just kind of, it's a farmhouse ale. It's just not at all what, I don't know. It kind of messes with your expectations.
I remember the first time I had this beer. We've probably been going on too long, but hey, whatever.
This is the last pod. We've gone as long as we want. That's the last. You just hit stop whenever you're done. It's fine.
That's right. I remember distinctly. It was one of the most memorable beer experiences I ever had. Sally, I don't know when I picked up the bottle, but Sally and I were living at our Hoyt Street apartment. Mm-hmm. Which was the apartment we were living in when we were married. And I don't know if we were yet married or not, but kind of early in our lives. This is now approaching 30 years ago. And it was a day very much like this.
Yeah.
It was a sunny spring day. And we had the big bottle. And we poured it out and we shared it. And it was so quaffable and so surprising. I think it's 6% or something.
This is 6.5. I feel like
that. Oh, yeah, 6.5. Yeah. We just hammered that back because it seemed like spring.
Yeah.
It seemed to have the quality of the moment. And I think we just drained our glasses in astonishment almost immediately. And then we were kind of drunk because it, you know, it was like, wow.
I remember my first is early summer. I had to get the whole big 750 milliliter bottle because my wife doesn't really drink beer. So it was all for me. And I think I ended up drinking the whole bottle without even sort of thinking about it. Just thinking, because like each sip, I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I kept drinking more and I'm thinking, oh, wow, this beer. And I kept wanting to experience it more and more. And I guess that's the whole point, which is that you just keep drinking it and you keep noticing new things. And yet it's just super enjoyable on its surface.
Totally.
It's a tasty, lovely, quaffable beer. So
I have to say something about Olivier Daedeker, the owner brewer there. On that same fateful trip. So Patrick and I spent, I think, 10 days traveling through the UK. And then I spent another 10 days traveling through France and Belgium, mostly Belgium. And we went to see Saison DuPont or the DuPont Brewery. And Olivier is by far, it's not even close, the most introverted brewer I've ever met.
A man after our own hearts.
A man after our own hearts. His energy was incredibly quiet and reserved. But yet he was, you know, he was clearly really passionate about this. His family, he had grown up around the brewery and he went off to college and he didn't want to have anything to do with the brewery. And he went off to the college.
Hello, dog of the pod.
There's the dog of the pod. The dog of the pod had passed out on the kitchen floor. And this
after happened, ingesting all the plastic from the recycling.
Exactly. This dog and your bone. And this dog, when she wakes up, when something wakes her up, she usually wakes up barking like that.
Wait, what?
Even if she has no idea what it is. So that was the dog of the pod. Now she's passing out in the sun. She's kind of a sun dog.
Nice. Aren't we all?
But Olivier went out into the big wide world and realized the brew is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And he told these awesome stories of growing up there and feeling like it was... it's in this town called Torps, which is this tiny town. I can imagine that anybody with any ambition in the world wants to get
the heck out. Yeah.
Exactly. What am I going to do? This old, fusty, old brewery that generations of the family have owned. But then he got out of the wide world and he was like, that's kind of a cool place. And he went back. And his wife is a microbiologist, PhD microbiologist, and she manages the yeast.
Nice.
So nice. Pretty good marriage.
Yeah. And by the way, this is one of my favorite, I'm going to call it a party trick, but one of my favorite things to bring. I bring one of those big bottles of Saison DuPont.
Yeah.
And it blows everybody's mind every time. And they love it. No, but I've never had someone say, oh, this sucks.
Right.
Everybody loves it. Everybody's like, wow, what the hell? And it comes in a nice cork and cage bottle, mm-hmm. and it's a great thing to bring.
Yeah.
And it's always a party pleaser. So for me, I chose this beer because at the end of the day, I think after all of this, after knowing you, after learning all the brewing and brewer stuff, if there was sort of one beer that I would sort of recommend one person to say, like, you know, to show them the possibility of this simple water, yeast, and hops concoction, I would give them Saison DuPont.
I would have purchased this beer for this, but I was almost certain you were going to bring it, so I did not.
We know each other too well.
And that's a good thing. I think that's one of the reasons this podcast has worked for 194 episodes.
Exactly. So. Interesting. All right. So, and by the way, get a little beeronomics because they put it in cans and are shipping it overseas.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, I bet this is not such a big deal in Belgium. Wouldn't surprise me at all if this isn't, you don't really find a lot of cans in Belgium. That would be interesting. I don't know. But yeah. I wouldn't be surprised because that's just purely a taste thing. I mean, we started with Sierra Nevada Pale and they're funny little stubby bottles. Packaging it's fashion. It's pure fashion. It's all what the beer is dressed up in, and right now in America bottles are horribly unfashionable, but I don't think they are in Belgium. So yeah,
I would suspect not.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about Europe, of course, is they've mastered the recyclable bottle and the reusable bottle.
Yes, that's
right. Returnable.
That's right. They get the bottles back, take it to the brewery, and refill them there at the brewery. And I bet they. You're right. I bet they still do that at DuPont. So.
Well, Jeff.
That's it, man.
We're
at
the end.
It's a wrap.
It's a wrap.
we had a good run.
Our friendship, our relationship with beer will go on, but our public-facing version of it.
That's right. This discussion
has to end.
As all discussions do, has come to its end.
Yeah.
I think that's good, and I think that's...
it's been super fun.
All of you out there who related to this will still be alive, so look us up. We may retire the Instagram feed. Just let it die.
We haven't really talked about any of this stuff.
Internet decay and the way that happens, but
it may still just sort of stay there, and
right.
You can still see a picture from 2023 when it's 2036.
Right.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? Who can say?
Yeah. At that point, the robot era will have come in, and it will be their choice of whether they leave those things up or not.
Well, you're still going strong. I'll be looking forward to all your blog posts.
And that's right.
Your Instagrams and your tweets. And I'll be delighted to see the Celebrate Oregon Beer. Did I get that right? Celebrate Oregon Beer and how that goes. And yeah. So thanks. Thanks, Jeff, for the memories.
Well, thank you, Patrick. And one of the reasons, just I think many of you who listened to this liked the rapport that we had because we're friends. So obviously we got along.
Our relationship with beer goes all the way back to 1986 and probably some, I don't know, Rainier Pounders or something.
That's right. Let's not talk about that because we were not 21 years old. Yes, but one of the reasons we did this is because we have not spent enough time together. Now, one of the reasons we wanted to do the podcast was so we could spend more time together. Now we're ending the podcast because it became a crutch. This is a metaphor that we had not talked about, but I'm going to throw it out here.
Okay.
And now we're just going to have to start us texting each other and saying, let's go get a beer. And
it'll be nice to just drink a beer with you and not have to worry about it.
That's right.
Talking about it on air.
That's right. No technology.
Yeah.
So that's our future. I'm looking forward to it. There's a lot of good beer podcasts out there, so I'm sure the world will.
You're well taken care of.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can make your own. You can make your own via AI.
AI, man.
Yeah, you want to know something? just ask AI. It'll tell you.
That's right.
For those of you who've been with us from the beginning, for those of you who've been with us just recently and all along the way, thank you very much for your listening. Thank you much for your contributions. It's been nice to know you're out there in sort of our shared beer nerdy world. You've been good companion. So to you, Jeff, and to everyone out there, have Patrick. Final cheers. And this on Saison DuPont.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go out on the top.
Go out in style. All right. Cheers.